why I came here. I think it was not to extend my personality, but to learn more about a historical peace church, the Mennonite Witness to Peace and the Mennonite Peace Services, and to demonstrate my sympathy and solidarity with this peace church. I think this was the main reason why I came to Elkhart and to Winnipeg. I hope to make this clear now in this lecture on the discipleship of Christ in an age of nuclear warfare. I would like to share with you the theological and ethical implications of the debate about armament and peace movement and the Christian peace movement in Germany. I believe that peace is the major theological problem of politics in the 80s, in this decade, just as unemployment is a major theological problem of the social system in this decade. We believe in God's peace in heaven and on earth, but what does it really mean to be and to become a peacemaker on a violent earth? Is the discipleship of Christ one way and sharing in world responsibility with the use of power another way? Can we in Germany, in the old Protestant churches, continue to remain just war churches? Or do we have to move into the direction of a peace church? Well, first of all, a few remarks on the history of the last 20 years. I think we have had three periods in this debate. The first period was in the 50s, when there was a peace movement, Kampf dem Atomtod, ban the bomb, not only in Germany, also in the Netherlands and the other West European countries. It was a time of the Cold War, the Korean War, the Berlin crisis in Europe, and the forced armament of a German army, and many of my generation who came out of war in prison camps resisted the terrible idea of another German army. In this time, only voluntary Christian groups, the so-called brotherhoods, the Bruderschaften, coming out of the confessing church, resisted armament in our churches. And the final debate was on a synod of the Protestant church in Germany in 1958, where the Franks were so strong that the only way was to say, under the word of God, we keep together. But this was the only tie between the two parties. Then we had a time of the detente policy in the 60s, and the peace movement seemed to change into peace policy of our government, especially the social democratic and liberal government. We found ways of a treaty with the Soviet Russia, with Poland. We found a kind of reconciliation with Poland and other East European countries. It was a time of the war in Vietnam, far away from Europe, of course. So we had a peaceful time in Europe. The peace movement declined in the 60s because the hope invested in peace policy was so great. Well, this then changed dramatically with President Reagan and his new conservative policy 2 years ago. Last year, 81, was the year of the outbreak of a European peace movement, a non-violent, very peaceful movement. And on the 10th of October last year, more than 300,000 young, and not only young people, gathered at Bonn. The great gathering was organized by two Christian organizations, not by any communist organization. And when President Reagan came to Bonn in June this year, 400,000 gathered to demonstrate for peace and disarmament, but they were allowed only to demonstrate on the other side of the Rhine in Königswinter, so that there was a Rhine in between the peace movement and President Reagan. the beginning of this year, we got a great support from a growing American peace movement, and this was a great support for us, because then no longer people could say that this is just a communist organization. We got really support from American Catholic bishops for the first time, and several churches declared themselves on freeze and other movements to go on disarmament. The reasons for the peace movement today are several, some from the outside and some from the inside. We live under the threat of Russian SS-20 missiles in Europe, as we all know. But we live under this threat already since 20 years. We're not SS-20 missiles, but SS-6 and SS-9 missiles. But they were all the time directed toward Europe. And then the second reason is the public calculation of a limited nuclear war in Europe by President Reagan and the Pentagon. And when this became public, all of a sudden the German people got the impression that this time our life is at stake. And then we discovered several things which we had repressed or forgotten for a while. One is, as Germans, we are living on the focal point of the tensions between the two great military power blocks in a zone with the greatest concentration of atomic weapons anywhere in the world, both launch pad and target of conceivable limited nuclear and atomic war, which could extend also in a universal Holocaust. We discovered that we still have around 5,000 nuclear warheads on the West German soil, and certainly a similar amount of Russian missiles in East Germany. And then all of a sudden we became aware that we are in West Germany, a country of limited sovereignty. The possibilities of a government to make this or that decision is very limited. And as one of our former majors of Berlin said, we discovered all of a sudden that we are still an occupied country with four foreign armies on German soil, the Russian army, the American army, the French army, and the English army. Nowhere else in the world you have an upbuilding of armies and armament as in Germany. So if it comes to an outbreak of warfare, it will be Germany this time. And therefore, this peace movement at the moment is not so much a students' movement only, it's a people's movement. It is not only a Christian movement, but a very much influenced movement by Christians. The Evangelische Kirchentag, the large lay gathering of our Protestant church in Hamburg last year, was really turned into a great demonstration for peace, not only by young people, but by all the participants, and there were around 200,000 in this large Kirchentag. So it's influenced by Christian groups, though not by the official churches. And then it is for the first time a movement not only in West Germany, but also in East Germany. For the first time we have an autonomous peace movement in East Germany, and this is really a miracle, because the policy of the communist government in East Germany was always called a peace policy. So they have peace missiles and peace tanks and a peace army, and in such an ideological state to create an autonomous peace movement is something new, really new. And then we feel that it is a crisis at the moment, not only of military policy, but of the whole political industrial system, both East and West, because the ongoing armament race is one of the major reasons for the growing poverty in the Third World. Can we really do this in a responsible way? The question to the church is, in our country and in the situation of our church, can the church as a whole become a peace church? or only committed Christian groups within our church. Now, we start with a line of argumentation. May sound in your ears already like a blasphemy, but I'm referring to the real situation in Germany. Can there be a justified nuclear war, or only a justified refusal of nuclear weapons? We begin with the major pronouncements of the Protestant Church in Germany, and especially the Reformed Church. There was a memorandum of the Church in the War and Peace Question of 69, and another one of 81, and then we have a memorandum of the Reformed Church in Germany of August this year. Wherever we start with these memorandums, we must assume that peace is the order and promise of God. God wants to live with human beings in the kingdom of peace. Our God is a God of peace. Because of this, the people of God are given their task of peace. Peace means not only the absence of war, but also the overcoming of suffering, anxiety, threat, and injustice. Peace is, in positive terms, the blessed, the affirmed, the good, splendid life with God, with human beings, with nature. Shalom. It is the commission of Christians to serve this peace in all dimensions of life, to promote it, protect it, and in particular to resist war, the most dangerous form of the lack of peace. Christian churches have always viewed their position against war as only one part of their comprehensive service of peace. Now, in view of the fact and possibility of war, there have been among Christians two different approaches, as you know. One is can be called a principled pacifism, that is, as a refusal of every act of violence, including those acts of violence by which violence is to be prevented. In this tradition, the discipleship of Christ is given priority over against political responsibility for one's own people. The responsibility for the consequences of this discipleship is given over to God, as Jesus said in the Sermon on the Mount, "Do not have anxiety." The other line is the doctrine of the just war. Whoever is not a pacifist always explains himself or herself with a kind of a doctrine of just war. We must be careful with this doctrine of just war, because with this doctrine the moral norms of good and evil, justice and injustice, are applied to the execution of war. The idea is not to justify war, but to bring war under the control of the moral norms of good and evil, justice and injustice. According to this theory, war must be conceived as a means of politics or a continuation of politics by other means. Yet we should be aware of the fact that the doctrine of the just war was not developed for the justification of war, but for the limitation of war. Because if you can really define what a just war is, you can also define what an unjust war is, and you are not allowed to participate in an unjust war. You must resist an unjust war. This is the idea. Now, decisive elements of the long-developed doctrine of the just war include the following principles. First, war must be declared by a legitimate authority. It must serve the common good of a state. This principle led a group of lawyers in San Francisco during the Vietnam War to make a move to the Supreme Court to declare the Vietnam War an illegal war, because it was never declared by the United States of America. The Falkland War was never declared, so an undeclared war is an unjust war, and you are not allowed to participate in an unjust war. Second, it must be conducted with good intention. Third, it must be conducted with the expectation of a good outcome. the general situation after the war must be better than the situation before it. All peaceful means for a resolution of the conflict must have been exhausted. The means of the war must not be worse than the evil which is supposed to be overcome by it. That is, the means must stand in the right relationship to the end. This is the principle of appropriateness of the means to the end. And number six, there must be a distinction between soldiers and citizens. The civil population must be protected. Now, those of you who find these considerations already somewhat macabre in the world today may apply these points to a doctrine of a just liberation struggle. And think, for example, about the struggle of the Sandinistas against the Somoza regime in Nicaragua. But we, in the Federal Republic of Germany, have to come to grips not with Somoza in Nicaragua, but with the possession or refusal, armament or disarmament, of nuclear weapons, of weapons of mass annihilation, and must, in this our situation, live out our service of peace as Christians and Churches of Christ. Now, the first is the doctrine of a just nuclear war. How is this? According to this doctrine, nuclear war is not to be directly justified, but rather set in limits. The doctrine says, the possession of weapons is not refused. Having nuclear weapons is part of the present deterrent system, which secures peace, as they say. The use of the weapons is subjected to the norm of appropriateness of the means and the norm of the differentiation between military and civilian population. It follows that the massive destruction of large cities with nuclear weapons is not allowed. Only the selective use on military objectives is allowed. Therefore, the old strategy of massive retaliation, in which the West believed for such a long time, is not to be justified. Massive destruction cannot be espoused, hence it is prohibited, following this doctrine of a just nuclear war, to be the first one to use nuclear weapons. Well, if this is prohibited, according to this doctrine of a just nuclear war, then it is also prohibited to prepare for its first strike capacity. So far, the limitations on nuclear war with the idea of a just nuclear war. In the further development of its nuclear weapons, the governments of the United States and also of the UdSSR are obviously following the position of the just nuclear war. The neutron bomb, Pershing II, and cruise missiles can be employed with precision against military objectives without causing massive destruction of civil population. So out of the old strategy of massive retaliation has developed the more finely tuned strategy of a limited nuclear war. Therefore, nuclear weapons are made more usable. The process of increased armaments is accordingly organized. With this, however, the threshold for the beginning of a nuclear war has been considerably reduced. And because no one really knows whether a nuclear war can be kept within limits, the situation in Europe has become not more secure, but less secure, because of this doctrine of a just nuclear war. We come now to the next doctrine on this line, the doctrine of just nuclear armament. This doctrine of a just nuclear armament, not of a just nuclear war, is maintained, unfortunately, in both of the pronouncements of the Evangelische Kirche in Deutschland, the Protestant Church in Germany, of which I have spoken, the Memorandum of 69 and again in the Memorandum of 81. The logic is as follows. By means of the parity of armaments, the present peace is preserved. The mutually credible horror of attack prevents a nuclear war. Because disarmament steps can be taken only on the basis of military parity, armaments must be increased. But this can be justified only if the so-called breathing space, the Atempause, or the grace period, die Zeit, die Gnadenzeit, is used to move from armed peace to a security system without nuclear weapons and to build up an international order of peace. This is in the two memorandums the justification for a just nuclear armament, that we find time and must use this time for disarmament. According to this doctrine, therefore, only the possession and threat, but not the use of nuclear weapons, may ethically be allowed. If, however, one is not ready to use what one possesses, no deterrence results. To this extent, there is an illusion here. On the other hand, which is more serious, it was already recognized in the 69 pronouncement, I quote, the expectations which in the early 60s were connected with international politics on the basis of armament control can no longer be maintained. The so-called breathing space or grace period which we gain from the deterrent system was not used for peace. Why not? I believe because the possibility did not actually exist. In the midst of the armaments race, one can hardly speak of disarmament. And even our Minister of Defense admitted that the speed of increased armaments is always many times greater than the speed of disarmament talks. We can see this today if we look at the Geneva talks on the limitation of middle-range missiles between East and West, and the preparation of a nuclear warfare in space already. Well, so we come to a kind of despair if we try to apply the old doctrine of a just war to the situation in which we live. We are obviously on the edge of an apocalyptic threshold. Many people today, the impression is growing that increased armaments of nuclear weapons do not secure peace, but rather lead more and more into collective insanity. The deterrent system have their own laws. Within the logic of these deterrent systems, it is not asked whether something serves peace or life, but whether it increases the enemy's fear of one's own strike capacity. Therefore, also intelligent conservative politicians in Germany say, peace based on nuclear deterrence must be called an ultimate threshold, because nuclear deterrence presents the threat of the enemy as world destruction. A securing of peace by means of enduring world destruction can never be stabilized as a permanent condition. This situation is therefore unsuitable as a foundation of a permanent order of peace. And that an apocalyptic peace of deterrence is not even capable of gaining democratic consensus, as Kurt Biedenkopf, which I'm quoting here, rightly said, shows, I believe, that in our nations, in our people, there is still a healthy human understanding. The nuclear armament race can only be done against the people. If they would really vote, I believe, and the polls show this, that 60 or 70% of the German population would vote against it. So you can do it only against your own people. And there is ethically no conceivable justification of a possible destruction of humanity and life on Earth in order to protect the rights and freedom in one of the social systems in which human beings live today. A peace which is bought with a threat of world destruction is, by definition, no peace. The peace of deterrence through mutual fear is a non-employment of weapons, but not peace. Mutual deterrence through fear is a condition of extreme lack of peace because of increased violence. Even without a nuclear war, the armament spirals already destroy the life of human beings and the natural environment. And the military-industrial complex spreads itself like a cancerous growth and affects all dimensions of life in our society in Germany already. Unnoticed, because so slow, a total mobilization of the people has come into being. We demand, therefore, and must demand, a withdrawal from the apocalyptic threshold, a freeze and a gradual nuclear disengagement and a gradual dismantling of conventional armaments. Otherwise, we have no options anymore. But is a withdrawal from this apocalyptic threshold still possible at all? Does not the turning back out of this apocalyptic death zone into life means a comprehensive transformation of the whole system in which we live? If, just for a moment, we would imagine that the nuclear threat did not exist and we would have to disband the military, dismantle the armaments industry, establish a state economy without a military budget, and free our souls of anxiety and aggression, that this idea sounds so utopian and that we have never thought through it seriously shows that we more or less quite pessimistically or apocalyptically believe that the point of no return has already been reached and we have become prisoners of the deterrence system. So we must now change the side and try to come to peace from another side. Live without armament, ohne Rüstung leben. A person who recognizes that the mutual deterrence through fear is based not on a parity of armaments, but on an armaments race, which is already now bleeding the nations to death and can lead to no good end, stands before the decision of either go along or protest against. It is therefore understandable that the old movement, which worked under the slogan ban the bomb or struggle against nuclear death, Kampf dem Atomtod, is being resurrected in Europe today and, remarkably enough, under the self-obligating formulation ohne Rüstung leben, live without armaments. The logic is quite clear. The use of nuclear weapons is irresponsible. If the use is irresponsible, then the possession can also not be considered responsible, for the possession binds the possessor to rearmament, improved armament, modernization, and, in the last run, also to the use. If, however, the possession is not to be considered responsible, then one must withdraw from the universal arms race and devote all of one's efforts to an alternative service of peace. To live without armament, ohne Rüstung leben, can have two dimensions, a personal dimension and a political dimension. Christians who place the discipleship of Christ over the responsibility for the world can deny themselves without making their own denial a model for all human beings, Christians and non-Christians. This was, I believe, and is the way of Anabaptists, defenselessness bound with a readiness for suffering and martyrdom. This is the way of faith, but this faith is not everyone's thing. And second, Christians and non-Christians who want to end the arms race deny themselves and make their readiness to live without armament a political proposal, an injunction for all human beings in their nation. In the first case, the risk is personal. In the second case, it is also political. In the first case, one takes the consequences on oneself and, of course, also on one's own family. In the second case, one must think of the consequences for others, for one's people. Wherein does the risk lie in the second case? Whoever disarms one-sidedly and brings to the enemy preliminary achievements for peace can, of course, by this very action, provoke the foe to aggression. even if no aggression results and the Russian army would not come to New Jersey or Canada, one can thereby become subject to blackmailing and extortion through the threats of the adversary. In this way, one delivers oneself and one's own to the more powerful foe. Therefore, whoever believes that nuclear war can be prevented only through a unilateral disarmament must be ready to sacrifice not only himself or herself, but also his or her own people. Such a person must risk the freedom, the rights, and the security of his own country in order to save the whole of life on Earth from nuclear death. Therefore, a more conservative organization in our church under the slogan Secure the Peace with these weapons say the slogan Live Without Armament serves not the resistance but the intensification of military practices in world politics. To be sure, this risk is not yet provable because as yet no one has made the experiment of unilateral achievements for peace, inviting the enemy also to go down with his armament. But it is a fear which cannot easily be laid to the rest. As long as the adversary is believed of capable only of the worst, but not of the rational. So as long as we assume that the Russians are capable only of the worst, we would never try the risk of a unilateral achievement for peace. But it may be that they are rational and then will take a rational step. I'm leaving now the argumentation and coming to a more personal and confessional statement under the presupposition, remembering the Sermon on the Mount. Up to now, both sides, those who want to secure peace by the means of nuclear weapons and those who want to secure peace by disarmament, have made their calculations if neither Christ nor the Sermon on the Mount existed. With Christ, however, there comes into the calculation a factor which suspends the whole process and changes everything. And this is the reality of God, which actually bears us all. You are children of your Father in heaven, says Jesus. And this remembrance calls us, first of all, out of the conflict. Whoever engages in a struggle and arbitrates a conflict stands under the law of retaliation. Otherwise, the parity in the conflict cannot be maintained. An eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth, armament, counter-armament, proliferation, counter-proliferation, etc. When we engage an enemy on the basis of the law of retaliation, however, we ourselves enter into a vicious circle from which we can no longer escape, because then we ourselves become the enemy to our enemy. We threaten what threatens us, and we hate what hates us. We are more and more then determined by the enemy. When evil is retaliated with evil, then there arises one evil after another, and that is deadly. We can be freed from such vicious circles only when our orientation to the foe ceases and another one becomes more important to us. The love which Jesus puts in place of retaliation is the love of the enemy. Mutual love, the love of friends, is nothing special. It's only the retaliation of good with good. The love of the enemy, however, is not recompensing, but rather anticipating, creative, and intelligent love. If you really love your enemy, you must be very intelligent and creative. Whoever repays evil with good is a really free person, strong and sovereign. He is no longer in the stance of only reacting to the actions of the other person. Such a person creates something new, a new situation for the enemy and himself. He follows his own intentions and no longer allows the law of action to be prescribed by his foe. Love of the enemy does not mean to surrender to the enemy, to submit to his will, to let yourself be eaten up by your enemy, but is a sovereign dealing with the enemy so that you create a situation in which enmity can be overcome. Jesus did not die with a curse on his enemies, but with a prayer for them. In his life, his passion and dying, he reveals the perfection of God. And therefore, he asked us, be perfect, even as your heavenly Father is perfect. But of what does God's perfection consist here? I think it's not a moral perfection. The perfection of God consists in that love which is long-suffering, friendly, and patient, which does not add to evil or carry a grudge, which bears all things, believes all things, and hopes all things, as Paul describes love in 1 Corinthians 13. God's perfection lies in the fact that he loves his enemies, blesses them, does good to them, and does not return evil for their evil. And it is precisely from this that we all live. The whole world lives from this divine reality, even if it does not know. God bears all, God maintains all, because he hopes for each one. And therefore, the analogy Jesus makes in the context of the love of the enemy is, look, God is like the sun rising on the evil and the good. And God is like the rain pouring down on the just and the unjust. So be like the sun and be like the rain. God's perfection is his limitless ability for suffering, for creating new situations. His almightiness is in his patient suffering, and in his patient suffering there is hope for all of his creatures. If we follow this line, the love of the enemy, then we should no longer ask what serves our security, what serves our survival. But now, in terms of this creative, intelligent love of the enemy, the basic question must be rephrased. What is the most helpful thing to do for the enemy? In what way can we best bless those who curse us? How do we do good for those who hate us? And let me remain concrete. As you know, we Germans fear the Russians and otherwise almost nothing in the face of the earth. Therefore, we must ask, what helps the Russian people to gain peace more? Our further armament or our disarmament? Or in what ways else can we change the situation in which we are with Soviet Russia in order to overcome enmity? In what way can we bless the communists who curse us? In what way can we do good for the peoples of the third world who consider us their exploiters and their enemies? This then is a major question. The politics of national security is in large degree a politics of anxiety and fear. Because we have anxiety, we demand security. And because we demand security, we increase our armaments. As we increase our arms, we give terror to our adversary. Therefore, our adversary also increases his arms. Quite to the contrary of this system, creative, intelligent love arises out of freedom. And this really is one presupposition for the love of the enemy. It is to overcome one's own anxiety and fear. Only if you are no longer afraid, you are ready to love your enemy. And as long as you are still afraid, you should be careful. But can one, however, really become free from this anxiety of death? One can become at least a bit freer from it when one recognizes the danger and consciously enters the risk, to the degree that the risk of a vulnerable, defenseless, but creative life becomes conscious to us, the more free and the more patient we become. Only the unknown and the repressed makes us anxious. And in this sense, I am personally ready and willing to live without armaments. We come now to some consequences. Last year, in 1981, the Gesellschaft für Evangelische Theologie, the Society for Evangelical Theology in Germany, of which I am the chairman, made a statement to propagate peace. And this was taken up then by the Reformed Alliance in Germany, the Moderam of the Reformed Church in Germany in August 82, with a very strong statement against nuclear war and nuclear armament, and I will try to explain this now. The way in which we make these memorandums and declarations is always somewhat pathetic, great words, but it is always an allusion to the Barmer Theological Declaration, which is behind all of these statements. So we said last year, Jesus Christ, as he is witnessed to in the Holy Scriptures and lives among us in the Holy Spirit, is our peace. In him the eternal God has reconciled the world with himself. Through him the world will be redeemed. Through the gospel he makes his peace to be proclaimed among us. There are no dimensions of our life in which we cannot be certain of the peace of God. There are no conflicts of our life, neither personal nor political, which are not embraced by God's will for peace with human beings and his whole creation. And there are no enemies, neither personal nor political, for whom God's will for peace does not apply. It denies God's peace if we must secure ourselves before our enemies by becoming enemies to them, that we encounter their threat with counter-threat and their terror with our terror. God's peace rather makes it possible for us to love our enemies creatively, intelligently, by understanding their suffering, by thinking through our own position critically, and by making every conceivable effort to dismantle their and our enmity. Love of the enemy is an expression of the sovereign freedom of the children of God and has nothing to do with weakness or submission. From the modern military means of mass destruction, there comes not only a deadly danger for humanity and all life on earth, it threatens us also with immeasurable guilt. And therefore we propose then the following line: the use of the means of mass destruction is sin, and then the possession of the means of mass destruction for the purpose of threatening the enemy cannot be justified either, because this threat is effective only if one is also ready to use them. The threat with means of mass destruction must also be viewed as sin. With the modern means of mass destruction, the limits of political responsibility of war and of the threat with war have been unambiguously crossed. Every martial threat and positioning which includes the possibility of escalation to universal nuclear war is irresponsible. The current peace through mutual deterrence is irresponsible. And in the Declaration of the Reformed Church, you can read it in this way: Jesus Christ is our peace, etc. And then it comes, this confession of our faith is incompatible with the opinion that the question of peace on earth among men is simply a matter of political calculation and accordingly to be settled independently of the challenge and the claim of the gospel of peace. In the face of the threat to peace posed by the means of mass destruction, both conventional weapons of mass destruction and A, B, and C weapons, we as church have often kept silence for too long. or not witness to the will of the Lord with sufficient decision. Now, as the possibility of atomic war is becoming a probability, we come to this recognition. The issue of peace is a confessional issue. In our opinion, the status confessionis is given with it because the attitude taken to means of mass destruction has to do with the affirmation or denial of the gospel itself. Now, what can the churches as churches do, and what can Christian groups as Christian groups do? I think we made 3 points for our German situation, and you must translate it to your situation. First, we must learn to love the enemy and what this really means. Wars are spread through friend-foe thinking, through artificially concocted images of the enemy, fears are used and aggressions called forth. Every real war is prepared with psychological warfare. Through psychological warfare, human beings are led to the disregard of life and mobilized for killings. The command of the love of the enemy enables the dissolution of these images of the enemy and the fears and aggressions which are engendered through them. If anxiety before the enemy is made the counsel of politics, as the fear of communists does in many Western countries, not only external but also internal peace is imperiled. The loyalty of the citizen to the government, which has been elected by them, is then no longer won through fulfilling the mandate to govern, but forced through by spreading fear, be it the fear of the enemies of the state, or be it the fear to be considered as an enemy of the state. The spreading of psychological unrest and public mistrust are the results. So whoever wants to spread peace will resist this, the use and engendering of fear in our people. So by historical and political analysis can free us from Russen Angst, fear of Russians, and Kommunisten Schreck, horror of communists, and make us capable for the necessary political encounters. This is perhaps only for Germans, but I don't know. The use of the fear of Russians and of the terror of communists is a strong motif for the question of national security and the armaments race. Second point, recognizing the real danger and cooperating on overcoming it. While taking up again and intensifying this East-West conflict, the great powers have repressed from the public awareness the much more dangerous North-South conflict and the danger of the ecological catastrophe. The new armament politics function at the expense of help for the Third World and leads to its further exploitation. The poor, also the poor nations, are already today paying for the arming of the rich and their security measures. Already today, intelligence capital are wasted for instruments of mass destruction and not spent for overcoming hunger in the world. Christians' service of peace must therefore consist in bringing the North-South conflict into much sharper public awareness and of becoming the advocate of the silent and dying peoples in the midst of the conflict over spiraling armaments. And then the last thing is an outlook only for our churches in Germany, becoming a peace church. The more the churches in Germany move from being churches bound to the state via a state church and concordates and contracts with the state to a free church, the clearer can become its witness to peace and the less ambiguous its initiative for peace. I think we are on the way, and we must go the way from a just war church to a peace church. I believe that the Church of Jesus Christ can become a church of peace without sectarian isolation from the world, and it will become a peace church to the degree that it confesses Christ and Christ alone as its and the world's peace and shows the necessary consequences of this confession. Let me end with the remark that I am convinced that pacifism, atomic pacifism at least, is no longer an utopia or an illusion in a violent world. It is the only realism of life left to us in this apocalyptic situation of the threatening world annihilation today. And a last personal remark, you know, two world wars started from Germany and brought immeasurable misery on the nations. We do not want to become guilty of a third and then the last world war. So please understand us and support us in the peace movement in Europe and help us that our churches become a clear witness to peace and become a peace church. Thank you.